Hi, I'm Bob Earl. I'm a drug addict and alcoholic. Glad to be here. Happy Chip Day to all the recipients, and birthday to, was it Jackie, was 16 years? Great. Virginia? Was it? Hey, I don't pay a lot of attention. I just... Listen, long sobriety is not a prerequisite for anything, you know. I got to Laguna Beach today and realized I'd forgot the map and didn't know where the meeting was. So, it works out. God, I wish I could, you know, I'm getting so goddamn tired. It's like, I wish I could give you a nice little, can talk. You know, just tell you a few old jokes. Quote six or seven interesting pieces of information from A, literature. Sit down. You know, tell you some funny stories about when I used to drink and use. I can't even remember anymore. See, I'm one of these guys that's of the school. If you're 22 years clean and sober and you can sit down and have a meaningful conversation with somebody that's new, there's something wrong with your program. Here we go. Gene, I promised my mother I wouldn't know. But I had an Al-Anon speaker up in Vancouver here about a month ago. Really, really put a great line out. I love it. And those of you who know me well will know why I love it. But she said she was told once by her sponsor that her responsibility was to disturb the comfortable and comfort the disturbed. So let me warn you in advance. I am here tonight to disturb the comfortable. I'm here to verbalize from the podium all the things, little voices down inside of you have been saying since you've been sober, but you've been ignoring. I want to talk about things like not smoking in sobriety. About mental health, diet, exercise, you know. Like I say, I'm here to disturb the comfortable. And if you're sitting out there and you're one of these people that's like all of us have been at different times, because when I was like 17 years sober, I was, you know, nuts, man, still shoveling in the sugar by, you know, tablespoonful and smoking. I hadn't drank coffee for about 10 years or eaten meat in 10 years, but that was about the only two I'd given up. And it's like... you know how it gets so tiring talking about this stuff. Because it's like it becomes like a war between me and you. Okay? Because I'm talking about shit you don't want to know about, right? So you put up all these barriers like, hey, fuck him, I don't want to hear this stuff, right? And I'm standing up here just trying to be peaceful and quiet and give out a little information. And I can't, because I find as the meeting goes on, I find my energy builds. I find myself, you know, getting more back into being, trying to be loud. And by being loud, get my point across and being more forceful instead of just very quietly and calmly trying to dispense a little information based on my experience here. So if you're wondering why you can't take care of yourself and you've had those little voices inside of you say at different times, God, I wish I could change my eating habits, or gee, I wish I could quit smoking, or boy, wouldn't it be nice if we could get off our ass and exercise, or wouldn't it be nice if we could do this? I've been in this job for 27 goddamn years, and I've hated 26 and a half of it. Why can't I leave? It's highly possible that you don't do any of these things because you don't think enough of yourself to take care of yourself. That, to me, is the tragedy of sobriety. I agree with the first speaker in that any answer you may want may be in the book, but sometimes the book will send you outside of AA to get the things that you need in order to survive here. All right? One of my biggest gripes has always been that we have a tendency here to reward failure more than success. And that's sad. You see, we have a... have I ever told the story of the travelers down here? Yes? No? No? Yes? No? Yes? We have a boat here. about a year ago, I guess it was, a guy called me up and was not on the program, had four house guests. He wanted me to come meet them. Two were psychiatrists and two were travelers. The psychiatrists were bright, very interesting guys with degrees in more than one specialty of psychiatry. I'm talking about, you know, that kind of brain. The travelers, on the other hand, were they have never eaten meat in their lives. They have never tasted sugar. They've never had a drink of alcohol. They don't know what a narcotic is like. They've never eaten salt. They've never eaten any meat of any kind. They've never taken any of these things into their body, and they were in their 40s. All right? They've just, at one point in their life, in this spiritual upbringing by their parents, someone said to them, God put the entire planet here for you to enjoy. And they said, okay, great. And they've been traveling for 30 years. Asking nothing, expecting nothing, and they've done quite well for these some 30-some-odd years, giving help where it was needed and knowing that they would get what they needed in return. None of these four gentlemen had ever been to the program of Alcoholics Anonymous, so I was asked if I would bring them because this friend of mine who was not on AA had been trying to explain AA to him, realized he was doing a bad job, and said, here, you take them. So I bring these four men to three AA meetings, participation meeting, discussion meeting, and a speaker meeting. And we got done. We sat down to talk about it. The psychiatrists, who I won't spend a lot of time on, were very impressed. and they agreed with what I'm going to say that the traveler said. But the psychiatrist gave the reason for our recovery as to the psychiatric benefit of the exact numerical order of the 12 steps and their, you know, right on down the line. A lot of jargon. The travelers, however, knew we were sober by grace. And they didn't have any more argument with that. But what the travelers couldn't understand, they said to me, they said, you know, we see these people and they have been inflicted with a terminal illness, a disease that will kill them, that will take their lives. They have come to this organization, to these meeting halls, to these places, and by grace, this disease has been lifted from them. It has been removed. And yet, instead of reaching out for life in all of its fullness, they sit in those rooms and continue to destroy themselves. They smoke cigarettes by the carton. They drink coffee by the barrel. They eat sugar by the pound. No one seems to get enough sleep. Nobody breathes, and everybody runs on a high level of anxiety. I would have liked to have argued with them, but there's no argument. There's absolutely no argument. I mean, this is gentle, peaceful people who looked at our program, who had no axe to grind, who wished no one here any harm, who would not hurt another person's feelings or harm them, they would die first. And they were only looking at us because they were concerned about it. Because they couldn't understand if we had had such a powerful experience spiritually to have a terminal illness ripped from us, why the hell couldn't we go on down the path with our Father? It was mind-boggling. The discussion meeting, there was one of these guys, you know the guy at the discussion meeting, he's always got to make his point. He makes the same point every week. And for 10 years he makes the same point. And this guy's sitting there, you know, with a dozen cookies piled up in front of him, and, you know, he's going through a cup of coffee, a minute, and a cigarette with every cup of coffee, and he's trying to make this point about, well, this is how I feel about my boss and the job, and you know. And after the meeting was all over, we're outside, one of the travelers came over to me just as gently as possible, and he said, probably one of the greatest spiritual things anyone can do is express their feelings. He said, and I understand that man's need to express his feelings. And then he smiled, but he said, how would he know what they are? I'm here to disturb the comfortable. If somebody said to me today, you know, well, what do you think the number one problem with the alcoholic is drinking and using? I'd say the number one problem is the drugs and the alcohol. If somebody said to me, what's the number one problem with the alcoholic sober? I'd have to say self-esteem. Self-esteem. We don't have any. apparently. A lot of us. I mean, I know some of you are filled with it. So light another cigarette and tune out because, this is for those that don't have it. And, I hit 17 years in this program and, I was a good AA. I'd read the book 20 times. One of my ex-sponsors is here. He's known me for 22 years. I went to the institutions. I spoke at the meetings. I hauled babies. I let them throw up on me in my car, steal from my apartment, drove 40,000 miles in 1 year just doing institutions and AA speaking, not counting business. I mean, what the program asked of me, I did. I rolled into 17 years of sobriety, and not much had changed. Not much had changed. I had a new career, which was a blessing. Somebody said tonight to talk about. Now I might not have time. We'll see. There's four of us up here trying to give this talk. Three are pretty much in agreement. One is really not least bit goddamn interested in the talk. What I did at one point in my sobriety, and I realize this now, and now I see all the countless people that do it, is you come in here, you work some steps, and you help some people, and you make some coffee, you mop some floors, you get active, you read the book, you do the steps to the best ability, and one day you slide into one day. And on that day, the boss doesn't give you a ton of crap. Everything's reasonably peaceful on the home front. You don't feel too bad about yourself. The meeting goes pretty smooth that night. And at night when you go to bed, you say, this has been a good day. And then you spend the next 10 years of your recovery trying to make every day like that day, right? So that 3 years from now, you're still going to the same meeting, you're still saying the same things, still sharing the same ideas because you don't want to rock that boat. You know, you don't want to get out of that comfort zone. God damn it, you finally got comfortable. You got a little peace of mind. Not a lot of feelings, but that's not important at the moment, you know. I used to think peace of mind meant feeling nothing. You know, obviously a lot of other people think that, too. At 17 years, a friend of mine suggested to me that it might be beneficial if I went and sought some outside help. And it was a reasonable suggestion. I couldn't think of anybody in AA that I wanted to talk to that I respected enough at that time that I could give two, you know, hoots about their advice or their direction because I knew too much about a lot of the guru's personal lives here. And I just didn't seem that would be an answer for me anymore. So I had always been open-minded to therapy. I fired every baby I ever had that went into it. If I wasn't good enough, screw them. Let them find their help elsewhere. But I was tired of being 17 years clean and sober, having a really good profession, being respected in the profession I worked in, making a lot of money in the profession that I worked in, and feeling like a turd. Every day scared that I'd be found out. Didn't know what or by who, but that I'd be found out. And when they found me out, it would be over. And not being able to accumulate anything. In other words, my self-esteem being so low that regardless of the amount of money I made every year, I would be broke at the end of the year because I would spend it all. If I couldn't spend it myself, I had a knack for picking women who love to spend money. Hey, I picked them and they did it. And, you know, I can't complain. I'd like to, but I can't. So I said, all right, great. I'll look into this therapy. Figuring it's that or die, 17 years sober. And I went and met this woman therapist because at the time I thought women were my problem. I'd been married 5 times in sobriety. It's about the time you're saying, I do, the 5th time, that a little voice which you don't want to hear says, maybe it's not them. I'd say to the little voice, don't be ridiculous. We know it's not. So I got this woman therapist, and we sat down. She said to me, tell me a little bit about yourself, and I did. And I told her how at 15 years of age, I was thrown out of Manual Arts High School and discovered the wonderful world of narcotics and alcohol. Now, I spent the next 11 years running narcotics from Mexico to California and in the streets with guns and all that bullshit that goes along with that way of life. All of the, bullet holes in me and in others. And then I come to AA, 26 years of age, gotten clean and sober, and I'd been living that way of life for 17 years. And she said to me, I said, tell me about yourself starting with your childhood. You weren't born at 15. So I don't remember anything. It's a blank. I can't remember anything before 15 years of age, maybe three things. And she, of course, knew that it was going to take us a while. She explained to me that's not normal. I thought, my God, I've written 32 inventories in Alcoholics Anonymous in 17 years. Every one of them started at 15 years of age. Why the hell didn't somebody say something to me? You know? And I went over all the people that I written all my inventories to, and I realized none of them could remember back past 15 years of age either. So it was no big fucking deal to them. You know, it was perfectly normal. Yeah, right, I understand. I can't remember my childhood either. It makes it okay, you know. So we went back and dug around to see if I could find out why an adult male, how the hell old was I then? About 42 years of age, could not remember his childhood. And in essence, what we discovered is that what transpired from the time I was maybe not born, but old enough to walk, was criminal. It was criminal. And that I used to say, people used to say to me, God, when I was a kid, I was beaten 3/4 to death every other day by my father, and I have a great deal of trouble with authority figures. I say, bullshit. What's one got to do with the other? What happened to you when you were a child got to do with what's going on now, today in your life? For me, I discovered it had a lot to do with it, because for me, I discovered this. It seems, apparently, that what goes on when you're small has a lot to do with how you feel about yourself when you're big. If you were brought up with a lot of love and attention, if you were brought up in a household where when you spoke it was important and people took the time to listen to you, if you were raised in an environment in which you were always encouraged to express your feelings, if you were angry, they'd give you a pillow to beat up or a sack to tear up or let you scream and yell until you were done screaming and yelling, never at the expense of others, but they would let you express your anger. Or if you were sad, they would let you cry. And that they would teach you how important you were and how wonderful you were and how special you were as you were, that you needed to add nothing. You didn't need to dress a certain way or drive a certain kind of car or wear a certain price wristwatch or have a certain kind of job. That as you were, standing there in short pants with muddy feet, you were beautiful. Okay? If you were raised in that kind of household, and those are the kind of people who brought you up, then the rest of what I have to say is going to have no bearing for you. You can sleep through the rest of it. If you had a few more difficulties than that when you were small, when you came running in the house crying with tears streaming down your face and you had a John Wayne alcoholic father like I did, with that bullshit macho attitude, and you stand there 3 years old, man, and tears streaming, and you know the line. All you guys know it, right? I'll give you something to cry about, you know. And when you lay there on the floor, you think, hey, fuck that, you know, no more of that, boy. You can put bullets in me, I ain't crying, you know. I'm showing no emotion from here on out. Yeah. Or laugh. Just giggle. They were so goddamn paranoid if you were raised in an alcoholic household, if you started laughing, they knew it was at them and they beat the shit out of you. You know. What are you laughing at, kid? It's a cartoon. It's a cartoon. It seems that that does a lot of damage to our ability to express ourselves and lead a normal life as adults. It seems that an awful lot of us carry a lot of that pain in. Apparently, I'm convinced today, not apparently I'm convinced, that really is not good wording here, but when you have more than one person trying to talk, you have those problems. I'm convinced today, now I forgot what the hell I'm convinced of, would you guys get it the fuck together up there so we can have a talk here? Okay, if I can't remember what I'm convinced of, I'll go on to somebody else. The thing that has set me free, the thing that has set me free is getting in touch with my feelings. I spent all my life not being in touch with my feelings. If Oh, okay. Now I know what I'm convinced of. Now hold that thought. Hold that thought. I'll be back to you in a minute. I want to get over here. Hey, I know those that are, you know, where I'm at on the same wavelength can stay with it. Those that can't, I don't have anything to offer you anyway. You come into Alcoholics Anonymous, you're an alcoholic. I don't think there's a finer program, a finer fellowship, a finer organization or anywhere in the world than this to deal with the problems of drug addiction, alcoholism, and any related compulsions and obsessions. Okay? We come in here and we work this program, and by God, as you go through these steps, and as you share with others, and as you do these things, the burden of the disease of alcoholism and drug addiction will be removed from you. You will get through your own guilt. You will get through, you will come to understand you have a disease. You will come to understand your behavior. You will come to learn how to give to other people. You will go through this whole process and these things will happen for you. And then you can go right on down the path of life. Happy, changing, spontaneous, enthusiastic, and successful. Successful does not necessarily mean a lot of money. It just means doing what you want to do. Living your life your way. So, if that's your only problem is alcoholism, that's what will work for you. However, I'm also convinced that if you were raised in an alcoholic household, if you were raised by one or more alcoholic parents, after you've gotten through the process of dealing with your alcoholism, and you have achieved that place where you're comfortable in your sobriety as much as you can get, know with all that's going on, because about 2 or 3 years you start to know that you're crazier than you were when you got here. That's just because the feelings are starting to come back, and you got to try and hold them down now with no chemical assistance. No narcotics. You can still use cigarettes, sugar, you know, coffee. No sleep. And don't breathe under any circumstances. Breathing is a bitch. Breathing will bring feelings up immediately. I'm convinced that if you were raised in the alcoholic household, you've got another issue. You've got another set of problems that at some time, at some point in your sobriety, you're going to have to deal with. I don't care how you deal with them. I don't care if you deal with them in therapy. I don't care if you deal with them in ACA. I don't care if you deal with them with a religious psychiatrist. I don't care how you deal with them. I only know based on my experience and the experience of the people that are close to me that if you don't deal with them, you're going to constantly be going through sobriety and nothing's going to be working, man. You're not going to be happy. Your health isn't going to be good. You're going to be in jobs you hate, relationships you can't stand. You're going to keep saying to yourself, I can't understand why I can't have a meaningful relationship with another human being. I believe that you've got to have one with yourself first. All right? I mean, if you want an excellent yardstick around here, next time you go to pick someone for a relationship, I mean, if you can, after the initial, you know, encounter, you can slow that down for half a second. Most of us can't for a while. Until we get tired of getting run over. But if you can slow it down for half a second, if you want to know how you're going to be treated when it really counts, when it really counts, when it's really crucial, watch how the other person treats themselves. Because they are not going to be able to treat you any better than they treat themselves. It will be impossible for them. If they can't take care of themselves, and they can't take care of their feelings, and they can't take care of their emotions, they can't take care of yours. No matter how bad they want to, they can't. As I get in touch with my feelings, and I honor my feelings, I understand your feelings. When I understand your feelings, I can really care about you. And also, an interesting thing about feelings, one of the reasons I never wanted anything to do with feelings is I always thought that I was responsible for how the other person felt. Which meant that, guess where you learn that, right? Growing up with an Al-Anon alcoholic, that's it, you know. Somebody's always taking the blame. Somebody's always taking the blame. So somebody's always at fault. This is your poor goddamn kid who hasn't done anything except sit there, you know. I mean, I hadn't said that to your father, he wouldn't have gone out and drink. Oh, I don't have a lot of respect for the co-alcoholic. None, as a matter of fact. You know, this bullshit of standing around and being quiet, smiling, and cooking dinner while the whole family is destroyed at your feet doesn't leave me a lot of warmth in my heart. Because that's what I went through with my mother. It might be nice to just try and rescue everybody and get them the hell out, you know. It might be, but everybody does the best they can with the tools they have. Did I have to start that one? I walked into Alcoholics Anonymous. I was about 6 months sober, 7 months sober. I know Eddie didn't say it to me, so I won't blame him. But I mumbled something to somebody in AME about my alcoholic father and how I was angry over something he had done when he was drinking. I think it was when he took me to a ball game. I was 8 years old and we were in Wrigley Field in downtown Los Angeles and he got drunk and didn't know the way home. And so I'm stuck with this drunk adult and lost, which was not one of why I've never gone to a baseball game. So I was mentioning some sort of that was not fair to do to a small child. And I got the standard cliche throw line. We throw a lot of lines around here like frisbee, you know. And none of them, of course, are in the book. And so he said to me, well, forgive your mother and father. They did the best they could with the tools they had. Intellectually, that's very sound. Intellectually, that's a really sound argument. Intellectually, I can accept that. My mind says, well, yeah, that's true. Yeah, okay. Sure. They couldn't have done it any better. So I said, all right, great. They did as good as they could. I forgive them. Now Christmas comes. Okay? So you go spend Christmas with a family, right? You forgave them. Everything's okay. You're sober. 9 months, 10 months, whatever you're sober. Take a couple of presents, best you can afford. Walk into this lunatic asylum where they're all gathered. Smiling and happy. Life going right on down the road to destruction like it was before. Everybody's smiling. Everybody's contented. You sit down with your little packages in the living room, you know, and mom's talking to the stepdad and the uncles are there, you know, all of whom are alcoholics. And everybody's just, hey, you know, Merry Christmas and shaking your hand. How glad they are to see you. And sitting there and suddenly, you know, I'm sitting there with my family and my throat starts closing. Because I want to say a lot of things. You know, I don't even know what they are, but my throat starts closing. It's like, I can't talk. Then I start to get acid indigestion. Stomach starts to get... I've only been here about 15 minutes, right, with the family. Then, suddenly, from inside comes a social psychopath that the state of California had to deal with for 11 years. And he says, fuck them! Get a flamethrower and torch the whole goddamn family! Well, by now, you've been well-trained in AA, right? And so the next thing you do, the immediate thing you do is you say, oh, God, what's wrong with me? What's the matter with me? What did I do wrong? What kind of program am I working to think these kind of thoughts? Oh, Christ, I got to write another inventory. I got to talk to my sponsor. Jesus, you know. And you go to your sponsor, you say, God, I wanted to torture my whole family. He goes, oh, you asshole. You know, you go, oh, God. What's wrong with me? Hey, nothing. Nothing. All that has happened is a little process here. You have forgiven them intellectually. You just haven't forgiven them emotionally. And until you can, you're not going to get free. See? You're going to have a lot of trouble with bosses and the guy at the gas station and the sales lady at the Broadway and anybody in authority is going to drive you nuts until you resolve these things, right? And I don't know any way to get to forgiving them for what they did until you get angry, see? Because I have friends who were beaten three-quarters to death as children, 2 and 3 years old, put into the hospital with their jaws wired shut, their ribs crushed, arms broken, children who were put in dryers, had their hands put in fires as means of punishment, kids who've been locked in closets and left for 3 or 4 days without food, kids who were totally beaten by both parents, girls and boys both sexually abused by their parents, alcoholic parents. And I realize we're all alcoholic parents, too. I ain't whitewashing ours, but you got to look at theirs, and it may help you deal with yours. And once you can get into what happened, when all these children and all these, you know, what really went on, the terrible denial we have, and you can get mad, okay? And you have every right to get mad because, yeah, they did the best job they could do. Right, I agree, but it was a rotten fucking job. Jesus. And we walk around pretending like, oh, it's no big deal, you know, hey, you know, show off a few scars, hey, what the hell. My old man meant well, he really didn't mean to drop me off that third story roof, you know. Just because my, you know, I have a friend whose parents told him all the time for 10 years, the first 10 years of his life, that he was the result of a failed abortion attempt with a coat hanger. I have another friend whose mother walked around the house for 2 weeks telling him that the only problem she ever had in her life with her was his father and him. At the end of 2 weeks, she killed herself. She took gas in the apartment with him in the apartment. And he almost died with her, but now I live. He gets to carry her. You wonder how much self-esteem you have? I mean, my parents loved me so much, I had high arches, right? I required special shoes. But I also had an alcoholic father who needed money for drinking. So when I came to money for drinking or buying me shoes that fit, they bought him his booze, right? So I wind up with practically a club foot that lays over on one side today because they didn't care enough to buy me shoes that fit. And when you grow up and people can't buy your shoes that fit, you don't grow up thinking you're worth much. And you don't have any sense of value. And until you can get to that sense of value, you're going to struggle. I don't care. I watch people walk around here and say, I worked 12 steps and surrendered to God and everything's okay. And I can just see the tension. They're just so goddamn tight they could explode. I've been privileged to go give this same talk to a lot of guys in another state who all of whom are over 30 years sober. And once they got past the anger, okay, they started to bawl like babies. Because I reached inside and I touched that child. I touched that child inside of them that they had ignored all of their sober lives. All of their sober lives they had ignored that child. Now, since I got in touch with my child, this kid in here who was so badly treated and so ignored, and I have a picture of him on the TV set at home before they got to him. He's about 18 months old. He's in a little sailor suit, and he's adorable. Blonde, curly hair, big blue eyes. He's got a stupid expression on his face. You know, just kind of... See, because children don't have to look cool. You know? I mean, there's a whole movement on it that tells you if you find the child, you'll find God. And it is through this child that lives in here that God will speak to you. I'm convinced of that. I believe that more from... Because the child is the only part of me, this little child that went into hiding is the only part of me that's not damaged. His intuition is perfect. Perfect. We all have perfect intuition. The problem is we don't listen to it because we have so many voices we can't. I mean, how many times have you been going to do something and the intuition says, no, you shouldn't do that. Say, hey, that's okay. Don't worry. It'll be all right. You know, my sponsor said I could. You know. And then when you're shoveling your way out of the pile of garbage, oh, God, how come that work? You know, next time I'll listen to my intuition. It's hard to listen to your intuition because you got to believe that you're of some value. If you don't believe you're of some value, then you don't think that anything comes from inside of you is of any value. If you don't think you're of any value, you're going to struggle just getting a relationship with God around here because your mind is going to tell you that if you're no good, God isn't going to want anything to do with you. So if you have my kind of mind, you're going to spend the first 2 years around this joint not even praying, knowing that the worst thing you can do is get next to God. That he's waiting in the bushes for you to get even. I have, let's see. Well, I don't know, I mean, I guess everybody, I don't know everybody, but a lot of us watch the Olympics. Now, for me, it was an incredible experience this time to watch the Olympics. I probably went through 12 boxes of Kleenex watching the Olympics. Because my kid was watching. Well, first, okay, I'll tell this story first. See, first you got to understand, you got to get the setting. If you don't get the setting, the story doesn't mean anything. One of the things in the whole world my child loves more than anything else in the whole world is teddy bears. So the people that know me know I have a lot of teddy bears. I probably have 30 teddy bears. I never go travel without them. When I go to conventions, I fly to other states, I'm on vacation, I always take, when I'm going to Honolulu to run a marathon, it doesn't matter what I'm doing. I've always got a couple of three teddy bears that travel with me. Little ones ride in a shoulder bag. If I take a big one, he sits in the seat next to me on the plane. What's the adolescent in me can't stand? Huh? You know, because he's got to look good, right? He goes, get the fucking bear out of the chair, will you, for Christ's sake? You know? The stewardess is going to think you're some kind of wimp. Move the bear. Put him in a baggage, for Christ's sake. Something. Get the bear out of the chair. But I'm used to it. He has to look cool. I just kind of love him anyway, you know. So, I have this house full of bears. Well, my child informed me that the bears wanted to watch the Olympics. So I said, okay, great. That's all right with me. You know, I'm into loving this child. So what I did was I put about half of them in the living room. And I put half of them on the bed in the other bedroom, turned both TV sets on. From the time the Olympics came on in the morning until they went off at night. Well, so if I left the apartment and went, you know, out to speak at a meeting or go to dinner or off for a business meeting or something, the TVs were on, the bears were watching the Olympics. Because that's what the child, I mean, my managers would come in, they'd know that fruitcake, right? There's all these bears lined up nice and neat in front of the TV set. watching the Olympics. Having a good time.
Yeah.
Because I got banners from other places. I had some Canadian banners, you know, and they had little Canadian flags, and they were cheering for the Canadians. But now when I was home, I would sit down among these bears, this child of mine, and we would watch the Olympics. And we'd be sitting there, and some kid would be in the process of competing in his event, whatever it was, and they would do one of those profiles on him, or they would just, or the announcer would come on and they'd say, well, Bill's parents spent 7 days on a motorcycle riding here from Minnesota just to be here to watch their son participate. And my child would die. He would die. He would cry so hard he couldn't stand it. Because the pain, just terrible pain, that nobody ever cared enough to come anywhere to anything he did. Whether it was goddamn Parents Day at school or Cub Scouts or anything, nobody ever came because nobody cared. And the fact that this kid's parents had gone through such incredible things, he would just bawl. He was so sad. Or the father who worked overtime for 2 years, 2 years, 4 extra hours a day, just to provide the extra money so his child could work at whatever it was he was doing and come and compete because he believed in him, supported him, and he cared about him. He did it. My child would just die. He would just, oh, God, he'd so. And at the same time, he was crying all these tears of sadness. However, he was also crying tears of joy because if the boy on TV went ahead and won his event and stood there and they raised the flag and he took his gold medal, the tears of joy that he had accomplished this would just pour from him, right? So my biggest fear always was if I got in touch with my feelings, life would get boring. Right? I'd be some kind of a wimp. That was always my biggest fear. If I get in touch with my feelings, I'm going to get gentle. If I get gentle, where I'm crying at things like the Olympics, people are going to take advantage of me. I got a handy piece of information for you. I used to run in the streets with two very tiny 11-inch shot, double-barreled shotguns. And it's harder to take advantage of me today than it was then. And I was not friendly, you know? And we're not a big conversationalist. But it doesn't matter. You can't take advantage of me today. Because I protect these people. I protect this child and I protect this adolescent. I take care of them because nobody else is going to. Well, I spent half my life looking for the person that was going to take care of them. You know, every relationship I ever went into, part of it was geared toward, can she take care of me? You know? I mean, we none of us want to admit we're looking for mom. Makes for strenuous relationships. Listen, girls, don't get too confident out there. No. We're still paying for the approval your father didn't give you, too. It's a two-way street. There are no saints in this arena. So, I'm convinced that if today, you know, if AA, the guys that founded AA, the first 100, well, let me, okay. It's fun. I have a lot of fun now. You know, there's only four voices now. See, there's the child, the adolescent, the adult, and the negative voice, of course, which thinks everything is shit, always will be, and I will never amount to anything. The cancer and fiscal disaster are coming up with the sun tomorrow. So, you know, that voice is always still there, but I don't listen to it much anymore. It talks all the time, but it just doesn't have the power it once had. So I'm down to four voices. So, I mean, from the 35 that originally were there, from when I used to sit home alone and put the chairs in a circle and have a meeting and go from chair to chair, you know. That's damn definite improvement, let me tell you. Yeah. This is peace of mind here, you know. Oh, okay. If the first 100 that founded AA were to find it today, 1984, I'm convinced that therapy, nutrition, and exercise would be integral parts of the program. They would be as mandatory as the steps aren't. Okay? Because these guys were very far ahead of their time. It's just that in their time, the benefits of these things were not as known as they are now. Another thing that helps me to believe that. See, we walk around here, we're saying, oh, well, hey, you know, I mean, we encourage people killing themselves, right? And you guys says, God, you know, maybe I should quit smoking too, right? He's got 2 days off heroin. I think maybe I should quit smoking too, right? You know what everybody says to him? No, you don't want to take on too much at one time. Hey, when you're kicking a heroin habit, I gotta tell you, right?
You know, you might as well throw cigarettes, sugar, coffee, meat, and a few other things in the pot, because it ain't going to be no big difference, you know. Not going to change a thing. And to prove that, in the first 100, one of the first 100 was a guy by the name of Tom Powers. And I'll tell you how concerned he is about the newcomer. He broke away from the first 100. He said, all right, look, you guys have got a great thing here. It's terrific. It's really wonderful, but it's not enough. You're not taking it far enough. It can go further. There was a little place in the Catskill Mountains called East Ridge. Now, I'll tell you what you give up day one. Day one, if you're a newcomer at East Ridge. You give up your drugs. You give up your alcohol. You give up your cigarettes. You give up sugar. You give up salt. You give up meat. You give up caffeine. You give up all processed foods and sex for an indeterminate period of time. You're going to get up early every morning. You're going to have a period of exercise. You're going to have a period of meditation. You're going to eat only the freshest foods, a combination raw and microbiotic diet. And you're going to work your ass off. And you're going to have encounter sessions every day. A lot of people stay. A lot of people stay. The lady in my life today went through the program about 9 or 10 years ago and then went back to Toronto, Canada, where she's from, and tried to adhere to this program. Okay? She got her 2 children back, and she would shop fresh at the store every day and get only fresh vegetables and fresh fruit, and she would cook carefully for them and make sure they didn't eat any sugar and give them fruit snacks. And it got them so well-trained, they'd even bring candy home and people give them to it and give it to her and trade it for an apple or something. And she tried, and she went to meetings. But every time in a meeting, she'd sit down and express a feeling, because they also taught them how to express feelings there. You know, they got into the insides immediately. And then she'd say, oh, I'm really depressed over the situation with work. It's so goddamn hard, you know, and I don't want to get back on welfare again with the kids while I try and change careers. I wish I could stick, but I'm really upset. You know what people would tell her? Maybe you'd feel better if you'd smoke a cigarette. Why don't you have a cup of coffee? You know? She did the best she could. She lasted 8.5 months, and as she tells the story, it all went one day. She had a cup of coffee, a pack of cigarettes, hamburger, hot fudge sundae, and a man. So here she is, 9.5 years later now, just getting back to it. You know, just starting to get back to it. I mean, just quit smoking 2 months ago. We're into macrobiotics and a few things like that, and just starting. It's like, you know, it's just like all that time has gone by, because there's no bad guys here. There's no bad people here. It's just that we've got to change. In other words, we got to start supporting health here. We got to start supporting success. We got to start, you know, even meetings that have non-smoking sections, they make, you know, everybody walks by and looks at the non-smokers like they crawled out from underneath a goddamn garbage can, you know. Because we don't know how. I went to one meeting where they put the smokers in a fucking room, right? Let everybody else out in the hall. I thought that. Why should we? Never mind. I'd go into secondhand smoke, but I just don't even want to start on that one. Well, no. No. Temptation is terrible. There's no bad guys here. The only reason we don't know how to encourage these things in others is because we don't have enough esteem to do these things for ourselves. And the only reason we don't encourage the expression of honest-to-God feelings at AA meetings is because we're all afraid of our own. And if somebody really pops up and starts to really express their feelings and really talk about stuff inside that's killing them, or talk about the pain of the child, or talk about being molested as a little girl and in tears and share that agony, we're afraid we're going to have to feel our own. You know, AA has a lot of meetings have a terrible cop out. Somebody gets up at the podium and expresses their feelings, and people in the audience go, "Oh, I get crazy, absolutely crazy." They've done that to me at a few meetings. I don't think they'll ever do it to me again. I get nuts. It's just another way of telling somebody to stuff their feelings. You know, to not tell. Well, I went to a meeting once, and I had I'd been watching an afternoon school special that day on TV, a little 1-hour show about kids, and this. It was a whole story about a little boy and his best friend. And about halfway through the show, I realized, God, I never had a best friend. I never had a best friend. And most kids that grow up in alcoholic households don't. Because you can't bring anybody home. You know, you can't bring the kids home, man, because you don't know what the hell you're going to hit when you hit the door. You know, it's impossible to tell. So you're embarrassed, you're ashamed, you can't bring anybody home, you got to go to their house. people get tired. You know, you always come in there, and they're not coming to your house. Your parents are tight with money because they got to buy booze, so you can't, you know, you can't offer it. The kid who you bring home wants something to eat. You just die. You go, oh, geez, God, don't ask for anything to eat. They'll kill me, you know. So I didn't have a best friend, right? And as I watched the show come to a conclusion, I thought, that's very sad. It's very sad that a young boy has to grow up without a best friend. Because where kids grow up with really good friends, it's a much healthier, it produces a healthier adult. That's all. It just produces a healthier adult. So I went to a meeting that night where I was speaking and expressed the fact that I felt bad because I never had a best friend. And these meatballs in the eyes go, oh. We shall skip what I said. Because I probably already fried enough people with my language to this point. That's not necessary. One of the things that you're going to do around here, if you're like I am, is even if you're 20, the attitude will be it's too late. No? I'd like to stop smoking. I'd like to change my diet. I'd like to change my job. I'd like to do this. I'd like to do that, but it's too late. Which is just another reason. It's just another voice from the no self-esteem. See? Oh, God. I mean, I'd like to just, you know, I'd like to just jump, shout, yell, scream, swing, and just tell you how goddamn important it is. The single focus in your life should be getting in touch with your feelings. See, because I'm convinced today, beyond a shadow of a doubt, that that's who I am. I am my feelings. This is it. I'm sure as hell not my job, because it can be gone that quick. I'm not my clothes, because they can go, you know, that's not going to change me. I'm not my house, it can burn to the ground. I mean, that's not going to change me. I'm not an expensive watch, it can be stolen in a minute. I'm not my car, if I'm nice, I'm not a personality, because we all, right, you know. Particularly adult children of alcoholics, you know, show me the party and I'll blend in right in. The one thing I won't be is me, but I'll be whatever the rest of you are, you know. Sit in the corner, watch for a little while, see how they're behaving, and then move on into the room. Hey, hi, how are you? I'm Bob, you know. It's a lowrider party, you just walk a little different. Hey, man, what's going on? You know, I mean, well, you find a personality, slide in, and that's it, see. So I'm certainly not my personality, because I can change that, you know, on a whim, complete with dialect, you know. So... I figured out that's who I am, or these feelings, that's it. That's what I'm about. So if you want to have a really good relationship, meet this person. Okay? Meet this person. Because I have a lot of fun with this child who I now love and take care of and take teddy bears wherever he goes and allow him to participate in the things that he wants to participate and don't care if it makes me look silly. The adolescent can't handle that, but that's okay. The adolescent, I've learned to love him. He's a little more difficult. He has some unresolved problems. You guys are all aware of the adolescent. He's the one giving you whiplash driving down the street. He's the one that wants to cruise the high school. While you go through mental anguish in your car, I'm too old to cruise to high school. I can't go. Come on, it'll be great. I'll love it. They wear dolphin shorts now. Come on, let's go. he can fall in love with a calf. He just watches a leg go by. Oh, yeah, it's her. I can tell. Quick, let's catch up, you know. So he's learning a little restraint, you know. It's the first thing was to teach him he was in a 48-year-old body. That's helped a lot. It's a major job, but it's definitely helped a lot. I tell the story. I'll tell it again because it's the best example I have. The adolescent, I was getting rid of a four-door sedan a few years ago, and the adolescent said, I want a Corvette. I said, I don't want a Corvette. The adolescent said, but I do. Great car. I said, I'll look silly in a Corvette. The adolescent said, no, man, it's long and fancy and beautiful and cool. It's great. I want a Corvette. I said to the adolescent, all right, what the hell? You never had a set of wheels you didn't steal anyway in your whole life. We'll get you a Corvette. So I got him a Corvette. Now, we had a big problem. The first big problem we had is children. You know what children are like. Children are like dogs when they're in a car. I mean, they don't care. They just want to hang out the window. You know, they hang their head out the window, and that's it, man. Well, the wind runs.
Well, the Corvette has T-roofs on it. All right. Well, the kid, when we go anywhere, we get on the highway, the kid wants the T-roofs off, right? Because the child wants them. You know, look at everything, see everything, you know, check everything out. The kid is just naturally curious. Which, by the way, once you get into this process, you'll discover that's one of the things you were never allowed to do when you were small, right? Okay, so now I got this adolescent. He can't have the T-roof off, right? Okay? Because the wind fucks up his hair. See? So now I got a child over here who wants the T-roof off and an adolescent over here who don't want the T-roof off. And I, as the parent now, must mediate between these two personalities. So what I did is this. I got a spray, went to the drugstore and brought a spray bottle for water and a hairbrush. So I could take the T-roof off so the kid could enjoy the ride. And then when we got where we're going, I could use the hairbrush and the spray bottle to fix the adolescent's hair. And everybody was happy. Okay? Anyway, the adolescent got too many speeding tickets and I took the Corvette away from him. I talk to him all the time. I say, you can't do that anymore. Last time we were on Highway 5, and, you know, we were followed 8 miles at about 115. And so that was the end of it for him. One last little story, and I give it up. I was watching an event on, and this comes down to all, really, I don't have to explain. I was watching an event on TV here a year ago, so, and they were interviewing this guy before the event. And he was saying that when he was 65 years of age, he was living with his son. He was retired. And his son came to him one day and said, Dad, I'm going to have to put you in a home. I can't keep you here any longer. And his father said, you can't. I don't want to go to a home. I'll do anything but be put in a home. That is the last place I want to go. I'd rather die. And his son said, look, You sit around here, you smoke cigarettes, you don't do anything, you're dying. You're sitting rotting away. You got to do something. His dad said, I'll do anything. His son said, well, in the morning, get up with me and come running with me. And the old man said, great, anything, anything. So the old man got up the next morning and went out with his son to go running. And the old man lasted a quarter of a block. That was it, 1/4 of a block. And he couldn't go one more step. His heart was pounding. He couldn't breathe, you know, from the cigarettes and all that. So the kid said, forget it. Just forget it, Dad. Just go back home. So the old man went home. He got up the next morning before the kid. He went out and he ran his quarter of a block again. And he did that every morning. At the end of about 3 months, it took him a month, I think, to get up to a block. At the end of 3 months, he did a whole mile. At the end of 3 months. And a light bulb went on inside of him. And he realized that if he was 65 years of age and he was in that bad a condition, then for the most part, his whole life must have been wrong. It must have been wrong. So he decided to change everything. And he gave up smoking and red meat and sugar and coffee and started to get into a positive kind of mental attitude, just thinking, you know, I can, I will, I'm okay. And that health is important, and he started to eat good food. Well, at the time I was now watching him on television, he was 83 years old, and he was ready to run his 14th New York Marathon. Just a little old man who anybody would have said it's too late. And he told the guy that was interviewing him, he said, you know what, man, I'm in better shape now than I was when I was 40 years old. 83 years old, running his 14th New York Marathon. It isn't too late to start taking care of ourselves. And it's going to eventually, at some point, become a very critical part of your sobriety. Because there are three major studies in now, all of which agree that the number one cause of people going back out and drinking again is diet, nutrition, and exercise. The absence of it is the number one cause of them going back. So, if a little old guy at 65 can crank it up, I don't see any reason we can't. God bless you.